G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
One man who's taken all before him is Adam White, who's ready to roll on a Monday morning, but in a very different setting. He's not in the studio this morning like he was all last week. Whitey, good morning. Come in.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Adam.
This is disconcerting because...
Why is that?
Well, because I'm not in the studio. It doesn't feel normal. It certainly doesn't feel normal where I am because I'm actually sitting in a construction site, which is my house.
Right.
I don't know whether... I think it's probably time to start panicking that we are getting a renovation done at our house, which is about halfway through. We've got no idea whether it's going to continue.
Oh, boy.
I'm not living where everyone else is living at the moment. Well, in fact, I am. I just got up really early and left. Rather than go to work, I went home because our house where we're staying at the moment is so small that with three young kids, there's no chance I could be doing it from home. So we've set up in a construction site.
So let me get this straight. I could see you, but you're not currently where you live. You're where you normally live, which is being renovated and under construction. So you've driven from where you currently live to where you normally live to go to work. Is that what you're saying?
That is exactly right.
Right.
That is exactly
you're
right.
You're an unusual man, aren't you?
David Knott, who is our head technician at RSN, he said, "Oh, it sounds really quiet where you are. I can't hear any noise." And I said, "That's because where I am, no one else is."
So how far is where you normally live from where you currently live?
About 7 minutes.
Right. So it's not quite the 25-minute drive in.
No, it's not too far. No. But I was a little bit like those outside broadcasts that we do in the spring carnival. I was scurrying around to try and get a newspaper from a petrol station. And no one had newspapers, or the petrol station wasn't even open. So I was a little bit panicky about that.
Well, there's nothing to read in the newspaper anyway. It's all right.
Well, that's probably true. How are you getting through? You sound a little bit grumpy. You were getting a bit grumpy towards the end of last week in the sense of being stuck, because you are a very busy man under usual circumstances.
Yes. Now, well, that's my challenge at the moment, just getting my head around not being as busy because the world won't allow me to be. And that's...
Yeah.
I don't sit in my hands very well, although I've become very good at doing bugger all, I must admit. I'm very, very good at sleeping. You know when you do nothing and you get more tired than when you do lots?
Yes. Yep.
Well, that's currently my state. I'm not doing a lot and I'm very tired because I'm not doing a lot. It baffles me that. The busier you are, the more energy you have, and the less you do, the less energy you have. I'm not sure how that works.
So I'll throw the question at you a bit differently. How are your kids coping? Because your kids are obviously a lot older than mine.
Yeah. So... they're going okay, the kids, because I think they're just in school holiday mode. So they're going okay. That was a week away from school holiday, so they checked in early and just gone, righto, this is my holiday period. I'm going to sleep in. I've got a 15-year-old daughter who just refuses to venture out of bed before 11 o'clock. Like, it's quite ridiculous how long she's sleeping at the moment. And my little 13-year-old boy, he's worked out, who normally gets up at 5:30, 6 o'clock to get to school because he's petrified of missing the train and being late, worked out that he can now school from home when he's at school. So he doesn't have to miss the train. So he sleeps until 8:30. It's quite refreshing to see him getting some rest. But the kids are good. My kids are good. They understand that this is just school holidays at the moment. And next week, or whenever it is, I'll be back at school in a remote situation and see where it all ends up.
See, I was kind of thinking about this, that when I was a kid, the thought of this sort of thing happening wasn't a bad thing because, you know, you don't have to go to school or you do your schoolwork from home, or and school holidays were sleeping in, and because I used to have to get up for school 5:30, 5:45 when I was young. So the idea of actually sleeping in, that's all you did. You'd stay up late and go to bed and wake up 12, 13 hours later. That's what you used to do.
Well, that's what I used to do, absolutely. Particularly in your teenage years when the body's moving and the hormones are rolling through, you just need some rest.
Yeah, but see, I can't do this at the moment. The reason I asked you the question is because your kids are older. My kids being 7, 4, and 3 in a very small house, sort of very tight confines. every possession is very much a contested possession. is that they rely on you a lot. And, the idea of getting a lot of sleep and all that sort of thing, no. I wouldn't have thought so.
So you found yourself on centre wing upon transition, bringing the ball to the fat side. You've got some time and space at the moment.
At the moment, I have, yes, absolutely. You feel completely different. There's a weight off your shoulders. But, it is a challenge. And, look, everyone is going through different challenges. But, and I'm being serious here, from our perspective, you're trying to keep the kids protected as to what's going on. And probably our eldest is the only one that is sort of cottoning on to what's going on. But, you don't want, we're not watching the news in front of them and all that sort of thing, and trying to sort of explain to them in their sort of way that they can understand what's going on. But, they can't see their grandparents, they can't see their cousins. They wonder why the most exciting thing they're doing on the school holidays is walking around the block. It's just one of those things. But it's amazing how younger kids, and I think that's what's given me a lot of perspective on all of this, is that they are unaffected in the sense that they're still having fun. They've got big smiles on their faces. They're working out things they can do themselves. There's a hell of a lot of cricket being played in the backyard, but it keeps perspective, I think, out of this.
Well, they'll just be happy that the family unit's together. We've never had dinner together more times in our life than what's going on at the moment. It's quite remarkable what's happening.
Yep. No, that's a good point. That's a good point. Where we're staying doesn't have a dishwasher, so that's fantastic. But these are things you realise. Even in such a short time we've been in this situation, it feels like a long time, you start to appreciate things that you just take for granted, don't you? And I don't know whether that's necessarily a bad thing for society.
No, absolutely not. No, there'll be a lot of reflection, no doubt, after this period or during this period, so that when we do get out the other side, get to the end of the tunnel where the light is just starting to glimmer, there will be some changes to perspective and lifestyles and attitudes, I would think, on the back of this. No, I don't think there's any doubt about that. We get through this, we'll get through this stronger and better and with a bit more balance in our life. Well, that's what I'm hoping to do anyway, I must admit.
What were your thoughts when you heard the latest from our Prime Minister last night? Did that make you feel comfortable in what the health officer said, the head man, the main man, Brendan Murphy? Did it worry you, or that, this could go a bit longer than we thought? What were your thoughts?
I actually didn't hear Brendan. I was doing another radio show at the time, and I heard Scotty do his thing, but I didn't hear Brendan. We chopped out of Brendan, but the public gathering going from 10 to 2 persons, I love the way they say persons, outside of your place of residence is not too dramatic, doesn't affect us really. Outside gyms and skate parks closing today. I haven't been to many outside gyms or boot camps. Or skate parks of recent weeks, although that affects William, the skate park situation. Staying home except for shopping, medical care or compassionate leave, exercise or work or education where you can't work remotely. Those things doesn't really affect me. And shopping for what you need, that's pretty straightforward what we've been doing anyway. So that part doesn't really change the way we've been going about it. What did Brendan say that I've missed? What did he say?
Well, I think what he said was, and it was, I think he was trying to say it in such a way that people didn't get complacent, but that we are, as a country, we are, at this stage at least, coping better than a lot of other countries. And that he made a real point that we can't be comparing ourselves necessarily to what's going on in Italy or Spain or even the United States, because we are a very different country. And while it is still relatively early for us compared to some of the other countries, that he was quietly confident that what we were already doing is helping in trying to smooth that that hill that we keep seeing about that graph. So I mean I think that's positive, but I think the other way of looking at it is there's a couple of times where the Prime Minister used the word 6 months, which was a bit of a concern. So who knows?
I did check in with my folks last night who were over the age of 70.
Yes.
Who now have been basically locked into their house, and I'm going to go over this morning and change the locks so they can't get out. and I was wondering how they were, but they were okay. Their mum and dad, they're okay sitting in their Ma and Pa kettle chairs in front of the TV. They were fine last night, so we'll see how long they last together. It'll be chaos in a week's time. We'll give you the tip. Absolute chaos in their house.
Yes. Well, my mum, now this is well and truly before the toilet paper scandal and all that sort of thing. My mum's got enough food in the house to last 12 months. She always has. We would never, there's always everything required. So I don't think she's too worried about that sort of thing. But mum and dad staying together for any length of time like they are at the moment is reason for concern.
You haven't done anything stupid throughout this period, have you, Whitey?
Have I?
Yeah, well, I'm sure you haven't, but because you know that our man, Frankie Dettori, a little Italian jockey back in the studio.
Yes.
He did a silly thing. And people are prone to do silly things, extreme things, go to extreme measures in times like this. Just to,
sort of regime-type situations.
Yeah, just to take their mind off things, to give them a distraction, which we're all looking for at this stage. But extreme stupidity is not something we suggest. Our man, who's done a hell of a job just by the way, decided he'd go on a juice cleanse last week. A juice cleanse, Adam.
See, juice cleanses, immediately you think, oh, that's easy. Because I'm thinking juice cleanse is like just orange juice, maybe mix it up, orange and mango, go the apple juice, that sort of stuff. But some of the stuff that goes in Joey's juices are words I've never heard of.
No, it's unacceptable. And what you've got, you've got 3 juices a day. Like, it's basically 9 seconds of meal. It's 3 seconds per bottle of juice, basically, straight down the gullet. That's your meal. Have a great time. Good luck. We'll see you in 24 hours. And that's not going to cut it. Juice isn't going to cut it, Whitey, for us to get through a whole day.
No.
3 bottles of juice? Give us a spell.
No.
Oh, hang on. He's giving me some feedback. He had 5 juices a day. That's 15 seconds of joy for your day. That's all that is. And he's come back a grumpier man on a Monday, so I'm not sure what the point was.
He is a bit grumpy today, isn't he?
Hasn't
got his normal sort of verve about him.
For a very buoyant young fellow, to see him so grumpy concerns me greatly. I'm not sure if Brendan Murphy's around, but if you can pop into RSN Studio, the Chief Medical Officer, and just check on Frank, that'd be great news, because I'm concerned about him. I'm concerned about the little fella.
Not have ideal. You been walking the dog?
Well, my word,
you're
I'm a dog walker.
Getting are you finding more people walking the streets?
I'm avoiding people at all times. I've been doing that for years now. This is not really new for the social
isolation. That's not normal. That's what I'm saying. I'm just living in my normal world.
Well, no, see, your normal world's changed forever now because the golf course is shut.
I really didn't want to talk about that.
Can't touch this. Break it down.
Everyone loves MC Hammer. Don't pretend you don't. Don't pretend you don't. And there's a reason we're playing this, Adam White. Stop, Hammer Time. I love it. How good. Did you know that MC Hammer's name, Adam White, is Stanley Burrell. And that's why he went with MC Hammer, because Stanley Burrell is a garbage name. Now, that's not going to get you to number one on the charts. But he did that on this... No, he didn't on this day. It's his birthday today. He turns 58... Today, I'm going to ask you a question, Adam White. 58 MC Hammer. What year was... You can't do this. Number one. What year?
I think it was either 91 or 92. I'm going to go with 91.
Pretty good. How'd you know that? Why would you say that, by the way?
Because I always judge things with what I was doing at school at the time and what year I was at school, and I reckon it was 91 or 92. Year 7 or year 8.
Close. It was 1990.
1990. All right.
1990. Pretty good get by you.
Vanilla Ice, I reckon, was 91. Remember Vanilla Ice?
Yeah. Ice Ice Baby.
And they used to wear the happy pants.
Yeah. Well, MC Hammer was a happy pants man.
Yeah, he was. I think he was probably the first for the happy pants.
He was the parachute happy pants. He was. He took it to a new level. Did my man the hammer.
Remember parachute tracksuits? Especially the parachute tracksuit pants were like... They were, like, really the big thing.
I was the king of the parachute tracksuit.
I can imagine that.
I can tell you, I was the king of the parachute tracksuit. There was no one who wore it more often or better than me.
In the 80s, it was the silky. Remember the silky tracksuit
pants?
Yes.
Yes.
And you'd wear the sports socks and you'd tuck them into the bottom of the silky.
Hard, yeah. I would.
And if you had Converse socks.
The tube socks.
I reckon Converse, if you had the Converse socks, that was like the creme de la creme that you would tuck into the bottom of the silky tracksuit pants. That was the 80s, and then the parachute tracksuit material was the 90s.
Yep, and I dominated proceedings for both of those, I must admit. Like, I took it to new levels. I wore the tracksuit pants as long as I could possibly do it. as long as I can possibly do it. Until I was told by my parents, you can't do that anymore. You're going to a wedding. I said, what?
So we're talking before about golf. Now, do you want to do that or you want to do your song first?
No. The Monday Morning Rockout is a very exciting thing to introduce to the program. We're doing that into the next break. But I need to talk to you about the golf situation because I actually thought of you straight away. I almost reached out just to see if you're okay. Once they had declared that golf courses were, in fact, now out of bounds. Pardon the pun.
Yeah, so obviously it was a big week for everybody last week, and I thought, well, I'm going to take the opportunity very late in the week to try and have a hit of golf, and was able to play, but was made to feel very guilty even in the pro shop. Even though the golf course was open, I was told, is this really essential travel to be coming here to play golf? And I said, oh, absolutely it is. And was sort of told, well, probably it's not. You probably should be at home. You shouldn't be driving to go and have a round of golf. Now, we played golf and there were things in the holes, so the ball didn't go right to the bottom. There was no rakes in the bunkers. The flags were in.
Things in the holes? What does that mean?
Well, like, you know, a pool noodle
that
you get. So they'd cut them up into small bits and put them into the holes. So the flag would get into the middle of the pool noodle. So the ball, it would go into the hole, but it would just sit. You could sort of see the top of the ball when it actually went into the hole.
Oh, right. So it didn't bounce off the pool noodle and just
That's it. I thought that was what it was going to be the case when I was told about it, but fortunately it wasn't. But there were no rakes in bunkers, so you play your shot and you try and smooth the bunker out with your foot or something like that. But generally, it was a fairly normal round of golf. I know of some golfers that tried to play last week where there were no pins in the holes at all, which would make life a little bit difficult when you're playing your approach shot, I would have thought.
Just go to the heart of the green.
That's right. So that was what was sort of going on last week, and then over the weekend, Golf Australia announced that they would prefer for golf courses to all shut.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
When you think of social distancing
and all that sort of thing.
Well, as we discussed last week, I distance myself from everyone when I'm playing golf because we just play different parts of the course.
That's right.
I would have thought if it's going to be a couple of activities that you could do in these times, there would be surfing and they'd be playing golf. But not to be. But I think we're just stopping everything, so it just eases the confusion, I imagine. That just, you know what? You just can't do anything just for the minute, so just don't even try. I imagine that's what's happened. They're streamlining the process. It's all too hard. Golf, what about this one? What about that one? Somebody will come up with something else. Then you've got to make rules for everything, and I think that makes it difficult. So they've got to a point where, all right, let's just put a clamp on these things for a little while. Let's bend this curve, get it back on track to a neutral position so we can manage with this coronavirus situation. And then slowly we'll start to unleash things a little bit, I reckon. I reckon that's what's happened.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I've kind of changed my mind on it a little bit in the sense of seeing what has happened to this point with the curve, with what has happened just over the last week or so. I do tend to agree that you think, well, geez, if you go hard at it now over the next 3 or 4 weeks or however long it has to be, then we're more likely to get back quicker rather than sort of being half pregnant, if you like. Maybe, yep. I don't know. It's a hard one to know, and I'm very much of the view that I know that everyone has an opinion on what we should be doing and all those sorts of things. And I think there's a lot of anxiousness and whether it be about the health of your family or whether it be the health of yourself, but also I think, you know, the economy, that everyone is anxious and is absolutely understandable, but you do tend to, in that sort of situation, want to have your own view on everything. And that's, and I don't know whether that's necessarily helpful. I tend to just go on what the key health people are saying. And they were saying that last night, you know, that everyone has an opinion and everyone's got a different opinion. But they're not just making this decision on one person. There's a group of them. It's like a panel. It's like the Tapsilotto situation with the government supervisors on the panel. You know, like it's not just one person making that decision.
Right. The Tapsilotto situation. I hadn't thought about it like that. But I think you might be right. No, yeah, just lock it down, get things to a position where we can start to control it a bit, and then we'll start to open things up a little while, I reckon. I reckon that's what's happening. And, as you've said at the top of the show, seemingly, the numbers would suggest that we are in a far better position. Now, if we don't get laconic and lazy about it and just loosen the strings too much, but get in front of the curve if we can and see what happens. But we're going okay. We're going okay in comparison to all the other countries that you've mentioned.
I've got the text messages come through 416 90 50 52 sort of asking about what do greenkeepers do to keep the golf course going. And I actually thought that exact thing over the weekend. Because, like everyone, no one knows when this is going to end. Do they just let the golf course rest for a month and, you know, not touch it and then come back and get back into it again? Or do they keep the golf course in good condition just in case? That's something I'd actually like to check during the course of this week to see what golf courses are actually doing.
Well, we've got our man from Torquay, the RSV Resort in Torquay.
Well, that's exactly right.
Who listens to the program, who was SMSing us last week. No doubt he'll be out there again doing the same thing, even though he's probably got no course to tend to at this stage for any competition or playing purposes. But I'm sure there'll be an answer out there somewhere from our greenskeeping friends in SMS land. Hey, Cameron Percy is one of our favourite Australian golfers. He's over there in the USPGA doing great things. Of course, no one's actually playing at the moment. I wonder if he's allowed to play on course anywhere. We'll find out with him because he's on the line with us on the Breakfast Club on a Monday morning. Cam, good morning.
Yes, hi guys. I'm actually walking in the fifth hole here. I'm out here on a golf course. And one thing I'm allowed to do at the moment is go to the grocery store and play golf. But I'm out here at the moment playing with my son, and I'm currently one up through four.
Well, that's good news. The form's good then, because we've just had those rights taken away from us, Cam. We're not allowed to play anymore.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, we've got all these rules. You can only play in a cart with one or walk. You're only allowed to have four people on the range at once. There's no rake. The cups are raised. So basically anything that you can touch, you're not allowed to touch. You've got to leave the flag in and stuff like that. So we're still allowed to play. So it was like, it's been crazy actually, because that's the only thing you're allowed to do at the moment.
Yeah, well, that was us before Saturday. They closed the course on Friday night or Saturday night here and said, just have a spell for a bit and we'll see what we can do on the back of that. But it's taken a lot of people by surprise and got a lot of people a little bit upset too, Cam, because that was one of those things you could do and you're not sort of amongst too many people. You thought you'd be able to get away with playing golf for a little while longer, but not to be. So my suggestion for you is, whilst you're one up through four, just enjoy the rest of the 14 holes because you never know how long it's going to last.
Well, I know I'm going to lose the fifth hole, so that's already a loss. So if he goes to the sixth hole, I might be one down. So here we go.
We were talking, Cam, about through the circumstances we find ourselves in, we are actually spending more time with our families. Now, this is a situation where a lot of the time you're travelling around the world, certainly around America, playing golf. Are you actually finding a way to almost cherish these times with your family?
I'm actually really enjoying it. I'm loving it because I've got something wrong with my wrist and I needed to take some time off anyhow. So I just had an MRI on my wrist. There's nothing broken or anything, but I needed to rest my wrist. It's also given me a chance to hang out with my kids. So I've actually really enjoyed it. I've been working, we've been doing a workout every day and then we play a sport like basketball or soccer or golf or kickball or something every day. So I've really enjoyed it. It's given me a chance. I'm probably irresponsible. I mean, but I'm teaching my kids how to play blackjack as well. So I'm playing blackjack and card games. I've genuinely really enjoyed it because I was about to head into a stretch where I was away for 7 or 8 weeks. So I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, so go half.
How difficult is it for the PGA players, the tour players, to not be doing this? I mean, you're having a good time with your family, but I'm not sure how many others have families or they're normally at home with their kids or family. But how difficult is it for the majority of the field to be not having a chance to play and do what they love, Cam?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of younger guys on tour now, so they don't have families. I know there's a young guy here in Raleigh. He's, like, stuck at home. He's 25. He lives in a nightclub district at Raleigh. Not as a big nightclub district, but he's stuck at home. He said, I'm just stuck at home drinking beer because that's all he can do. So it's tougher for those guys, but for people like me and with kids and families, you know, I know on Twitter and this and that, a lot of guys are posting stuff they're doing with their kids and they're actually really enjoying themselves.
What's the mood of America at the moment? Obviously, it's sort of, I think it's fair to say it's caught the world by surprise, but it certainly caught America by surprise. What's it like going down the street, talking to your friends? How scared are they, or is it just everyone's sort of just come to terms with what's happening?
Well, so first of all, our kid's soccer coach, he had like a blood disease 2 years ago and nearly died. So he's got a terrible immune system. And our kids' best friends are his kids, so we normally play together. But those kids are stuck at home. They've been home 3 weeks now in isolation. And the dad, doesn't go out. They've literally stayed at home for 3 weeks. And the wife had to go do the shopping and stuff because if he catches it, he's dead. So we've got that side of it. And then we've got other friends that don't seem to care at all about it. Like, we're supposed to be in self-isolation at the moment, and she lives like 2 blocks away. She come driving down on a scooter last night and hang out. Like, I'm supposed to be here. And she goes, don't worry about it. I haven't got it. I'm fine. You're not going to catch it off me. And I'm like, well, I don't know where you've been. And so there's two sides of it. And then when you go to the shops, everyone sort of sticks to themselves. So you just a supermarket, everyone's sticking to themselves. The roads are empty, so there's no one on the road, which is nice. So it's been there's been two sort of things. Either you're really scared of it or you're completely blasé and you don't really care. Those sort of attitudes, basically.
And what's the general media line on that, Cam? Is it be scared, be terrified, be petrified, or is it we've got this under control from a media perspective?
No, I keep seeing these things, the media are scared of people, but we just watch the show over here, ABC, and it's just every night they'll come on and they'll do like the White House press conference and they'll have their experts. Start with what we need to do. We watch that for an hour and they just basically tell us what's happened today, what we can and can't do. And then after that, the local stuff comes on with like our local governor will come on and talk and tell us, because we've got into lockdown officially in about an hour and a half. We officially go into lockdown, so the whole state. So he comes on and tells us what we're going to do. So there's been no real panic, but I'm watching because they're coming up with stuff like, I wouldn't worry about it. It's no big deal. And then other people are panicking. I'm like, I don't actually understand what they're watching. Plus, one of my good friends here, he's an ER doctor, and he was just about to go back to his 7-day shift, and he was telling us what's going to happen and stuff, and I spoke to him, and he said it's not real good in the ER ward right now. So it's he's actually physically seeing the people coming in and dying in front of him. So I've got a bit better perspective, I assume, because I've got friends in the front line. So, it's not real good. You don't want to catch it, that's for sure. You're not going to survive it if you catch it. So, if it gets into your lungs and whatever, it's really hard to survive.
The V8 Supercars. Supercars Australia has been in the news in the last little while with what's happening in the world of sport. And we've got the CEO, Sean Seymour, who's been good enough to join us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. How are you?
We're very well, thank you. Appreciate your time. How busy has the last couple of weeks been in supercars, considering there's been some big decisions to make on the back of the Grand Prix situation, but also what it looks like going forward? How busy have you been?
Yeah, ironically, you think things would be quiet, but I think like anybody else in business at the moment, we're flat out scenario planning.
And I read with great interest last week that the 2020 Virgin Australia Supercars Championship could run into the early part of next year because you want to deliver a full season. How did you get to that outcome?
Oh, look, that's a conversation that we've been having with all of our partners, and obviously our priority is to deliver the 14 rounds. We've got plenty of room this year, but depending on when restrictions ease, we do need to be prepared to go into the early part of next year to deliver the championship, and we are.
So, obviously, there's three been postponed at the moment. Simmons Plains, Auckland and Perth are going to be run at a later date. Who knows what else happens in terms of which other events might need to be postponed. Is it just a matter of squeezing them in a bit tighter on the calendar, like midweek action, or is it always going to be weekend activity for the supercars?
Yeah, right now we're only looking at weekend activity. The teams have got plenty of experience being innovative with the calendar. Last year we did a back-to-back round, so we actually ran out of Tassie one weekend straight into Phillip Island the next weekend. So the teams have got experience in doing that. We know what the challenges are. You know, there's unique challenges coming out of different tracks. The cars need a lot more time to be repaired coming out of a street circuit than they do a racetrack, because they take a lot more of a beating. So we understand the nuances. The team's entrepreneurial folk, and they always figure out a way to make it happen.
Sean, we have spoken to a number of sports through this challenging period, and a lot of them are in trouble. Where do V8 Supercars sit at the moment, just in regards to financially and how perilous it could potentially get? Hopefully it doesn't, but how potentially it could get for you?
Look, right now, the big question that we need to answer is, when are we going to be able to go back racing again? And I think that's the same for any sport in terms of being able to generate audiences and tickets, etc. But then what does it look like when we get back? So we're working backwards from that. Obviously, if we have to do two-day race meetings, if we have to bunch up the calendar, if we have to do TV-only events. So we're working through all of those plans at the moment. Once we've got a very clear picture of what all of that looks like, then we're able to ascertain what we need to do in the short term to make it there. Obviously, the government advice is changing daily. There's a new stimulus package coming out this week. There's advice around gathering sizes changing almost daily. So we have to be flexible and agile, and that's exactly what we're doing, like every other business in Australia.
Do you come under any...
Absolutely.
Challenges with the venues themselves, Sean, that you booked in for dates, I imagine, a while ago. Having to change those, does that become difficult?
Look, certainly there's a couple of nuances, a few nuances, particularly around the building, construction and deconstruction of street circuits. And Bathurst is something that you would want to move at your peril, right? So for us, Bathurst is very important to keep. And then for us, the other piece that we need to consider at the end of the year is the turnaround time between the Gold Coast and Newcastle, because we use a lot of the same infrastructure to build those tracks. So you can't have those two events too close. And then from there, all of the circuit owners that we work with, all of our government partners, all of our sponsors have been absolutely brilliant, very supportive, very flexible, and continue to do so as we go into week three.
So, Sean, how complicated could it be? I mean, we're seeing a situation where horse racing is continuing, at least at the moment, and there's no crowds. We saw the AFL season play its first round with no crowds. But if you've got a street circuit, it's almost impossible to keep crowds away. So how would you deal with that?
Yeah, look, I don't think that we would consider street circuits for a TV-only product. That wouldn't make any sense. The cost of the build would make it uneconomical, let alone the ability to manage social distancing. So for us, what we're working on right now is getting our head count, our footprint, as low as possible to be able to deliver a TV-only product. Obviously, we've got 24 cars out there with significant pit crews, and then you layer in TV people, marshals, security. Quite quickly, we get up close to 500. So the operations team now focused on, at a racetrack, what's the minimum number of people we need there to deliver fans the best product on TV? And we're pretty comfortable with where we sit. Now it's just a matter of understanding the relaxation of any restrictions. We don't think they're just going to get lifted overnight. As we've eased in and they've become stricter, we anticipate that they will ease off on the other side of it. So it's all about timing right now.
Jenna Ohay is the captain of the Australian Opals, and basketball has had a big weekend. We know that the Olympics has been pushed back, so the Opals don't get a chance to go out there and dominate proceedings in Tokyo and take home gold for another year. But the 2022 FIBA Basketball World Cup is due to be held across September and October in Sydney next year. Sorry, 2022, obviously. So it's going to be a big 12 to 18 months for basketball in Australia. I want to find out what the skipper of the Opals thinks about that. Jenna, good morning.
Good morning. How are you both?
We are very well, thank you. Appreciate your time. Dear, there's been a bit happening in basketball of recent weeks.
There has indeed. But, with not a lot of good news stories going around at the moment, it was exciting to get the news on Friday that the World Cup will be held on Australian shores in 2022.
So I'm not sure how much time you've had to get the programming and planning and your head around all this, but how does it change the calendar for the next couple of years, considering the Olympics has now been pushed back pretty much effectively into a World Cup?
Yeah, well, I think it kind of works out better. You know, with the Olympics being pushed back, we'll have a good lead into the Olympics next year, play the Olympic Games, and we'll have played lots of games together, and then the World Cup is the next year. So I think with the timing of it, it works pretty well. We'll all be playing together and have good chemistry and have plenty of time together. So I think it's really good for us.
How different are World Cup tournaments as opposed to Olympic tournaments? So I imagine they're different to play, and from a, I don't know, the way you have to attack them and approach them. Is it different or is it the same?
Oh, good question. It's been a while since I've been to Olympics. The last one was in 2012. I think the scheduling of the Olympics and the World Champs is different. As the World Champs, you generally play two or three games consecutively, whereas in the Olympics, it's game, day off, game, day off. So scheduling is the main difference, but they're major world tournaments, and they're the two pinnacles for basketball.
Now, Jenna, you've obviously just finished your domestic season, so you kind of got it finished just at the right time. What are you doing now, like everyone else in this country at the moment?
Oh, well, that's still a work in progress. I still haven't figured it out entirely. I don't live in the biggest of houses. I just have an apartment. So indoor workouts aren't the easiest to do. But I do have a dog, so I have been getting down to the park and doing some running sessions. I'm still getting my head around everything. It's not easy. But also with WNBL season at the moment should be in October, I do have a little bit of downtime to get some injuries right. I hurt my wrist towards the later part of the domestic season. So want to get that 100% and just rehab sort of other bits of my body so that for the next 2 years, I'm ready and raring to go.
So what happens in that situation that, as I said, we're all in it? Do you talk to your teammates about what they're doing? Have you sort of just got your own thing that you're doing? Have you been surprised with what some of the guys out there are doing? How are you sort of helping? Who is helping you get through this time?
So with the Opals, we have a strength conditioning, Jan, who has sent us, she sent us outdoor running sessions, she sent us in-home workouts, sort of body weight and with bands. So she sends those through weekly. Everyone sort of does their own thing though. We're all, you know, at our own houses, in our own states, we're not together. So everyone's just figuring it out on their own, but we're all still really close. We all chat and yeah, everyone's doing their own thing.
And what about your take on all of this? How you see it looking for basketball looking forward? We've spoken to a lot of sports in the last couple of weeks, Jenna, about how things might be different. Or is there a different look that basketball can give us going forward to make it more attractive, make it more efficient? Have you got your head around what the changes might be to basketball, if any?
Oh, I hope there's no changes. I like the 4 10-minute quarters. I wouldn't want to go any shorter. It's not the longest of games, I don't think, compared to some other sports. So I hope it stays the same.
From a domestic scene and a football perspective, as we narrow the focus a little bit, we know that the VFL will have its challenges going forward on the back of some clubs not being able to support them, the AFL clubs and their alignments disintegrating and being dismantled on the back of the financial situation that clubs are now finding themselves in. The Sandfall is one of the nation's best state-based competitions, has been for over 100 years, and Matt Doldig is the general manager of the Sandfall. And I want to find out what the situation is over in South Australian football, so he's been good enough to join us this morning on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Matt.
Morning, half 40. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. We are wrapped to have you on the program. I've been reading a bit about state leagues in the last little while, having an interest in the competition with friends still playing and coaching and the like. And the Sandfall has come into conversation in the last couple of days or so because there is real concern now, Matt, about whether or not it will get on the park at all in season 2020. And who knows what that means going forward. How dire is the situation in the Sandfall at the moment?
We're similar to a lot of other sports organisations and businesses. We're facing some really challenging times ahead. We're still aiming towards getting a season away this year, but like everyone, we're listening and reading to all the announcements, and only last night the significant announcements. So we're playing it a little bit by ear, but our intention is to get a season away. What that looks like, we're just going to have to work through how long we have, and then we have the complications of running into October, November, as the AFL does with cricket. But our intent is to play some football, but we'll be led by the federal government and the health agencies of when we can get back on the park.
If it doesn't go ahead, will it affect the club's futures?
Look, they're going to go through a really challenging time coming up. It's tough at Clubland as it is, and this has really put a dent in things. Obviously, we base our revenues around people coming to watch football, and then the hospitality industry and both are completely shut down at the moment. So to suggest we've got some challenges coming up would be an understatement. But what we've found over the last 14 days is that the club group has been really united, along with the Sandful, of making sure we can work our way through this and ensure we've got 8 strong Sandful clubs out the other side, whenever that may be.
We spoke all last week, sorry, Whitey, about the pay, not dispute, negotiation between the AFL and the AFLPA. Will there be a softening of the cap or a slashing of the cap if you do get back on this year, just because clubs, players won't be playing the amount of games perhaps that is required in the season, but also the clubs won't have the finances to pay them what perhaps has been promised?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, a lot of clubs have had those discussions with players already of what that looks like if we do get back on the field, but quite simply the clubs won't have the revenues coming in for probably the next at least 3 or 4 months. So what the competition looks like at the end of 2020 will be significantly different to what we thought it was going to look like. And then again in 2021, we're going to have to look at all of our structures. One in particular is our salary cap, and trying to put some downward pressure on that to help the club survive.
Are there any clubs that are under more pressure than others, Matt, in trying to get through this period?
Yeah, we do. We have a couple of clubs that have always been pretty tight. But as you know, over in the Sandful, we've got a really loyal band of followers and supporters still of the Sandful competition. And we're starting already to see a bit of that. We're seeing some memberships actually grow, people jumping on board and making sure that our Sandful clubs are here going into the future. But yeah, no doubt we've got a couple that'll be, this is going to be a really testing time for them. But like I mentioned before, the great thing is that we've got a really united group, and we're going to make sure that there's 8 Sandful clubs here in 2021.
One of the other things, Matt, that happened to the SANFL last year was the bringing in of the mid-season draft, and a lot of your clubs were decimated by that. If the AFL chooses to lift the level of lists to get through a period where they might be playing sort of twice a week, is that something else that you worry about?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we support players and their dreams of being able to play AFL football. So to have, I think we had 4 taken in the mid-year draft last year was fantastic for them. But what it does to our Sandful clubs is a significant impact mid-year to lose their key players. So again, this year, if we're back up and running in the AFL is also, it'll have a detrimental effect on our playing list. But we know that 2020 is going to be a really challenging year, and we need to be agile and we need to adjust. So we'll work with the AFL to make sure that they can get a good product on the field, and hopefully we can too.
Now, I'm very poor at economics and all this sort of thing, but one of the things that Scott Morrison was talking about was hibernating businesses. Is that something that the SANFL or other sporting leagues could look at, in hibernating teams, hibernating a league to try and give it the best chance of surviving on the other side?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, our Sandful clubs have almost gone into hibernation already. Now, they were pretty skinny staff structures anyway, of sort of 8s and 9s, and they're running just with a CEO at the moment and a part-time CEO at that. From a Sandful perspective, obviously, we've not only a big competition, but over 200,000 participants a year. So we need to keep the wheels moving a little bit to make sure that when we can get people back on the field, we're ready to go, because we know that sport and football in particular is going to play a pretty critical role in connecting the community back together on the other side, whenever that might be, hopefully sooner rather than later.
What else happened on this day, Adam White, is that there was a debut of a very, very polished young man who went on to be one of the greats of the Australian Football League. We know him as part of our family here on the Breakfast Club. 3-time premiership player, Norm Smith medalist, Brownlow medalist. Jimmy Bartel debuted on this day in 2002, round 1 against the Bombers. Jim, good morning.
Morning, man. I was actually more enjoying the talk of the Cricket World Cup. I think a week after that Mitchell Starc ball, my head bounced on about a good length and I was knocked out cold in the middle of the MCG. So I sort of don't really remember too much of the Cricket World Cup a week before.
But the good news is you remember getting your head bounced in the MCG a week later. So that's not a bad result. Great
scheme of things. Got some good photos of it. Joel Selwood was nice enough to take my mouth guard out of my mouth for me so I could go to sleep in the middle of the G and just really soak in the experience of the MCG.
How many times did it happen?
Oh, it was about the last, I reckon, 20 seconds of the game. We were playing the Hawks, actually. And I think Taylor Dre tackled, and I got my arm stuck behind me as I was trying to handball, and just head bounced on the ground, and it was, you know, Mr. Goodnight.
Yeah, I do remember that. Because it was quite, you weren't really aware of what was going on, Jimmy, but there was a fair bit of concern for you at the time because it seemed a relatively innocuous incident at the time when you saw it straight up. And then the concern, you know, there's a fairly significant delay in the game and there was genuine concern because obviously it wasn't the first time it had happened to you.
No, not at all. But look, as you can look at it a little bit lightly now, but you know, concussion serious, but, you know, Joel Selwood often reminded me after that. He goes, mate, what are you doing? The game wasn't over and you're just having to lay down. But I'll tell you what, the wicket was hard and quick. Not that the Kiwis found out that day. I was at the MCG for the Cricket World Cup. And geez, I'm with you, Whitey. The roar when Mitchell Starc absolutely ripped through Brendan McCullum. But it turned out to be a bit of a fizzer of a final. But that was an absolute beauty, that ball.
It was a corker. What do you remember about 2002, Jim, against the Bombers?
Well, a bit of a team here, not too much. My first kick of the game, I played on the great Smoking Joe Massetti. I'm in that illustrious club of first kick smothered, so an ineffective kick who was out of a centre stoppage. So I got the start and the centre bounce. It was against the Bombers who, you know, coming off that powerful Bombers side, you know, Premiership 2000. They were rolling, obviously, in 2001. You know, there's Hurd and Fletcher and all sorts of superstars everywhere. Smoking Joe was my match up in the middle. Smothered kick. About 2 minutes later, Dustin Fletcher crunched me. I think I had a little bit of mild concussion there. And then about into the second quarter, I think it was Dustin Fletcher crunched me again. And I think Paul Barnard got me a good one. So, yeah, I got bounced around like a, you know, a hacky sack that day, and we got beaten by 10 goals. So it was a great start.
No, it was only 50 points. Don't overdo it. It was only 50 points that loss.
We kicked a couple late, did we?
You must have. It was 10 goals at three-quarter time.
Yeah, I was going to say, Essendon were 10 goals up at three-quarter time.
Yeah. No, they were a great side, the Bombers side. I think everyone, you know, 99, 2000, 2001, they only grabbed the one premiership, but, geez, they had some players there.
They did. Well, you had some players in that team too, because not only was it your first game, Jim, but it was also the game of a young man who now doesn't have a lot of follicles on top, but did have at the time a luscious locks of sort of mousy brown hair. Gary Ablett Jr. debuted that day as well.
Yeah, he looked more like the surfer from Torquay instead of like Max Brenner, the chocolate man. I played Geelong Falcons with Gaz Jr. and we sort of came through together, so it was almost comfort in numbers when we arrived at Geelong Footy Club. And look, from a selfish point of view, for myself and actually David Johnson, the brother of Mark Johnson, who played that night for Essendon, made his debut, it was easy for us because, of course, all the focus is on the Son of God. You know, everyone sees it. So you could go about your debut with, you know, no one really knowing. And the roar when he came, because he started off the bench, and, you know, the Geelong fans, when they saw him come on, just lost their mind. You know, they're seeing the Son of God, Gary Senior's son, run out and play. And he did a couple of nice things. But unfortunately for Dave Johnson, on his debut, he broke his ankle and missed the whole entire season when he went up for a marking contest. So Gaz sort of did all the hard work. He was out in front of the media and the press, and the crowd were focused on him. And I could go around and get crunched.
What was it like for Gary, Jimmy? I mean, as you were still a first-round draft pick. We often joke about, you're, you know, top 10 pick, and there was pressure on you as well. But from Gary, who's always been that sort of shy type, how did he cope with all of that in the lead-up to his first game?
Yeah, look, it's hard. You know, you don't want to talk for other people, but, like,
he definitely felt it because there was always pressure on him. And as you said, he was very, very reserved, very, very quiet, didn't want any fuss. He loved playing the game. He almost just wanted to get it done and play, like get out there and play. And I was a bit the same. Like, you weren't nervous about the game. It was just everyone, you know, always, you know, at you, oh, you know, do this, do that, do this. And you're like, okay, I've got the main points. I just want to get out and play. I think starting him on the bench probably helped a little bit. You know, you take in a bit of the atmosphere. You take in the big crowd. But, look, I think he handled himself pretty well. Didn't have a massive night. I think a lot of people probably expected him to absolutely dominate from off the start. But he did some nice things that night. Again, we got belted, but it was a cool experience playing your first game at the MCG.
Yeah, he had 8 disposals for the game, Gary. You had 13. How many games, or was it that night, that where you thought, you know what, I reckon I could go all right at this. I am good enough to be able to play AFL football. When did that sort of sink in?
Well, to be honest, Whitey, I never really got that feeling throughout my career because, look, I wasn't the most natural of athletes, and I think people always expect, you know, your first-round draft picks, you get the comparative stuff. So obviously there's Luke Hodge at 1 and Chris Judd's already off looking like Chris Judd, a freak of nature and things like that. And other players probably started their career a bit quicker than I did. I just never felt comfortable. But I think that helped me, that sort of mindset that, you know, I've just got to keep pushing because someone will always take my spot. And I'd get that sense, I guess, even every year when you guys see it as well, and everyone in football, whenever the next crop of draftees, the way they write them up, you know, oh, this player is the cross between a Chris Judd and a Joel Selwyn. You're like, jeepers, this guy's going to win 6 Brownlows in a row. And then they come in and they're putting out record 2K time trials and they're bench pressing 500 kilos. And I'm like, oh, geez, I can kick a footy, all right? That's about it. But you've always sort of, I think the insecurity was actually in your position was a good thing for my career. The fact that, you know, I'm going to fight for my spot every time.
Yep.
Well, it worked out pretty well for you, Jim, that attitude. You got through okay. You got through okay. Just on that on that start of that season, because the year before in 2001, the Cats were 9-13. And you mentioned the dominance of the Bombers, sitting 12th out of 16 teams. Was there a sense that there was an opportunity there for the Cats? It took a while to get there, another 6 years before 2007 came along. But was there a sense that there was something building at that stage?
There was a bit half, because there was 2 drafts. I know everyone talks about my draft with myself, Gaz, Chappie, Stevie, and James Kelly. And then the 2 years before, you got Lingy, Chappie, Joel Corey, Corey Enright. So majority of the list, it was, you know, out of your 40 players at that stage, I think of that, they had about 25 under 21. So it was almost like the franchise clubs, or, you know, the new licensed clubs we see when they started out. We had a couple of blokes over 25. Even at that stage, Matt Scarlett and Tom Harley were only 23. So you could tell at training there's a real focus at the footy club to get character. And I know a lot of clubs say, you know, we pick character and that, but you could see it at training that they've gone after some pretty fierce competitive people, and they actually followed through on saying draft a character. Obviously, you need to be skillful enough or have the ability to play AFL, but there was a real focus on, you know, they called them those competitive animals or competitive beasts, and it started to show out at training. You know, when you're doing competitive drills, blokes were just going at it like it was a game in every training drill, and you could just see it building and building. And look, it did take 6 years, but we had a little bit of a run in 2004 where we made a prelim probably ahead of time. Brisbane knocked us off, even though I think we had about 60 inside 50s. 2005, that, as I say, the Buddy Nick Davis game. So we're coming along well, yeah, just with that group. But you did have a sense that, you know, we won a VFL flag in 02 with all that young group. So you could tell the talent and the ability, but it was more that competitiveness and that drive in the group to push each other that, you know, there could be something special.
We had learned late last week that Carlton and the Northern Blues had been forced to dissolve what's been a very, very successful partnership from an AFL-VFL perspective, which means Josh Fraser, the coach of the Northern Blues, is out of work and looking for something to do going forward. He's a former number one draft pick, of course, a champ with the Magpies, and he's been good enough to join us on the Breakfast Club. Fraser, good morning.
G'day, Half. How are you?
All right, mate. How are you? Has it sunk in yet?
Yeah, it has. Yeah, it's taken a couple of days. That's for sure. It's been a big week, mate. And I think as each day's rolled past, it's probably got a little bit harder. But you know, you certainly feel for all the people connected to the Northern Blues, both past and present. And you know, it's a very sad time when you lose a footy club of that type of history. But yeah, look, there's a lot of people doing it tough at the moment. The footy industry is no different. And hopefully, mate, when all this blows over, people have got work to go back to, but it's certainly been a challenging time.
Yeah, and I think you're in probably a unique position, Fraser, that you're involved with, obviously, the Blues in the AFL, but having that VFL role as well, and understanding of the old Preston Footy Club, the Bull Ants, which is now the Northern Blues, and that no longer being around, you cop it from both ends. Do you feel like it's your whole footy world has sort of collapsed around you?
Yeah, in some ways. I mean, I guess part of my mentality with coaching the Northern Blues was to try and revive as much as we could the old Preston Bull Ants and the Ants spirit. And you talk to any of the players that have played at that level with us, and they certainly reference that. So we never ignored our history and our past. It was something that we held very close to us. And, I mean, even to deal with people on a regular basis, our president, Stevie Papel, and so many good people that were associated with the old Preston Football Club. And as I said earlier, it dates back to over 100 years. So you're talking about so much history and tradition, and it actually meant a fair bit to various people. And on the other side of the coin as well, obviously my involvement with the Carlton Football Club in the development coach capacity. So, yeah, certainly been hit from both ends, mate. But, yeah, that is the way it's fallen. And I understand the situation. I understand that clubs, and in this case Carlton, have to make strong decisions to ensure that they're viable moving forward. But it doesn't make it easier to swallow. In fact, it probably makes it a little bit harder. But, yeah, as I said earlier, hopefully there's enough coaches, and my fellow colleagues have got something to go back to shortly.
Josh, obviously it happened so quickly, this whole coronavirus thing. Did you see it coming to you and to the Northern Blues at any point, or was it you were just completely blindsided by it?
No, I was blindsided. I thought there was a chance, you know, being stood down without pay was a real possibility. I guess I never envisaged, particularly because how quickly this thing has come, I never envisaged that, you know, the Northern Blues would be disbanded, because you'd assume that, you know, you'd always need some sort of club or format for your players that don't play senior footy to go and play. But naturally, that's something that will be worked out moving forward. But yeah, I probably never expected it to be wound up as quickly as it was, and was always hopeful that you know, we'd find a way to work through these things. But you know, I trust that the decision makers have exhausted all of those options, and yeah, it's just an unfortunate set of circumstances.
Did you think? What do you think about you having a bit of a chat there about what it might look like going forward from players who aren't playing AFL footy? Have you broadened that thought into what the VFL or the second tier competition might look like going forward, Fraser, on the back of what's happened and what might, is likely to happen with other clubs and their alignments?
Yeah, it's a reasonable point, Half. I've sort of thrown a few things around in my own mind, but I haven't been able to come up with anything concrete. I guess it's such uncertain times, and you know, unfortunately, I think the VFL for a few years now has probably faced some uncertain times in terms of what that looks like moving forward, and you know, the alignments, and obviously the old VFL, VFA clubs, you know, where does that leave them as well? So I think it needs to be reformatted. I think it needs to be heavily invested in, if that's the way forward, and we think that that's a really critical pathway for players, which I believe it is. You know, I think it needs to be remodelled and invested in heavily, and really, you know, shore up its future so that we don't lose, certainly don't lose the clubs like Port Melbourne, Coburg, Williamstown, those types of clubs, but yeah, we can make the second tier VFL, AFL, I guess, pathway, you know, much stronger.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.